Welcome back, folks, on No Filter Friday. We want to know what's going on your mind. Talk about any issue that's out there for you. Give us a shout. We got Donna on line one. Donna, what say you?
Hi, I'm calling about topic you were talking about earlier about the marijuana. Mm-hmm. If the state would just let us grow our own, we wouldn't have all that problems you're talking about.
Well, but that doesn't do away with the folks locating in your state and growing marijuana. I mean, unless it passes countrywide, you're still going to have the excess production and the illicit marijuana. That's always been the challenge. When you leave it to the states like what they've done, you have disparate rules and laws, and that's what the Chinese that have come across the border at the beginning of the Biden administration, they've set up these operations now. And in a short period of time, they're now dominating many of these markets across the country.
Yeah, but it's still for the old people who use it for relaxation and for relax their muscles and control their pain, growing it themselves would be a whole lot safer. We wouldn't have all these problems with people ingesting pesticides and whatever you were saying.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you get rid of some problems and you create some problems. Yeah, I don't disagree. That's always been the issue with marijuana. You know, it's always interesting people saying that they're going to set up this cottage industry and it's going to stay this way and not understanding how this works, because when government taxes the legal side, the illicit side is not taxed, and you know it just makes them even stronger. But the real challenge with marijuana, it's so easy to produce, right? You can take some seedlings, some 6 cups, go grow your plants, put them in bigger cups, grow them a little more, and when they're ready to harvest, you yield about a pound of weed.
Well, yeah, you sound like you've been growing it.
Nah, I've been studying this issue for a long time, been talking about it because I know the dangers and the downside implications of what's happening. And just about, and I don't like to pat myself on the back, but almost every prediction I've made as it relates to the legalization of this product has come true. And there's still more to come our way. And that's why I took the time to read this report today, because there were things after 40 years in law enforcement that shocked me in that report this morning, that in such a short period of time, Chinese illegals could cross the border of Mexico into the United States and in a span of 3 years dominate the marijuana market in some states. It's crazy that that could happen, but it's happening. And it's out there, and it's going to be a real challenge for us for sure. Donna, thank you so much for the call. Patrick's up. Patrick, what say you?
I wanted to discuss biological warfare, and coincidentally, it kind of goes well with the marijuana discussion earlier. But I want to talk about the magnitude of biological warfare, which begins in atheist communist China. Now, back in June of 2025, a Chinese national was arrested in the United States. It did make national news briefly for smuggling a biological material plant fungus. The scientific name was Fusarium grammarium or something like that. And This plant fungus causes significant agricultural and economic damage when it would be spread around. So that's another aspect of the whole thing. And then most particularly, I want to discuss COVID-2019. And in fact, I did call your show on a free speech day in late 2019 or early 2020. And I was saying I believed that the COVID was ultimately a bunch of nonsense. And not that I'm in denial that there is a new bug going around since 2019. But the problem is atheist communist China wants to destroy America in so many different fashions, financially, biologically, you name it. They're out to destroy this country. And then the real problem is within the country, we've got communists like Lindsey Warren of California, who are receiving millions of dollars from pharmaceutical agencies, and we're not talking about one COVID vaccine alone. We're talking about multiple COVID vaccine, AstraZeneca, Moderna. You know, there's a bunch of other names. Some were supposedly going to be a single dosage vaccine, and some were going to be a multiple dosage vaccine. And coincidentally, the fear is growing again now because they're saying because of the summer heat, it's on the rise again, a new strain. And, you know, then there's the people I want to talk about a mandatory vaccine. Well, I want to finalize my statement by saying I thank the Lord God Almighty that I never got one vaccine for COVID and I never will. Somebody would have to put a gun to my head to make me get those poison potions.
Did you ever get COVID?
If I did, it you know, I can't say that I've never had a not perfect day of not feeling well during 2019, 2020. But I'm pretty sure I really, in reality, never did get it because I do have some breathing issues, and my breathing issues were pre-documented before 2019. My health kind of went down around 2016, but that was all documented beforehand.
So Patrick, you're challenging the existence of a COVID-19 strand? No, right?
No, I'm not. I'm not challenging the bug itself. What I am saying is that in the Wuhan bat soup market in China, they created that garbage because they wanted to, you know, get it to the free world and to bring us down. And then all of the money-making ventures in the pharmaceutical age, there were multi-billionaires made through the pharmaceuticals because of all the varied COVID vaccinations, and I don't ever want to get a mandatory vaccination.
I don't know about you, but I watched a little bit of the Kennedy hearing yesterday about all of this. And I just wish that there would be a way that the federal government could put up a chart of the inherent conflicts that exist between science and medicine and the manufacture of vaccines and pills and everything else. Because as I watch every hearing, what I learn is another little tidbit in what I would call a frailty of the process because of conflicts, because of people making money, people rendering opinion and making money rent, you know, based on that opinion, making a decision about the viability and the efficacy of these drugs to the general public. And then we learned years later that they made $1.5 million for the purposes of whatever little bit of research that they did in order to validate that particular drug or otherwise, separate and apart than what we're paying them as taxpayers because they're working for NIH, FDA, CDC. It seems to me that these organizations are completely, totally replete with conflicts, ethical conflicts, and they just, it's no big deal to them. And what I'm realizing is it's a big deal to me, and I think it's a big deal to you, because you become more skeptical, more cynical, you know, about what it is that they're saying.
Yes.
And when you add to that, and I don't know, you know, if you've been to doctors, but I mean, I've had a lot of family members go to doctors with kind of weird things. And, you know, doctors are telling them as patients that they're seeing a lot of weird stuff, too, a lot of inflammatory stuff that they think is the byproduct of either COVID or the vaccine. They don't know. They're not certain. And I think a lot of that uncertainty that's out there, we don't talk about it much, is driving, I think, some of the skepticism of the general public as to the efficacy of what we're doing. I think there are a lot of people like you that are not going to take another vaccine. They're not taking another shot. Did it save lives? Probably so. You know, was I advocating for it at the time? Yes, based on the best science. You know, my attitude was I was going to trust them till I couldn't trust them anymore. And even some of the doctors that I talked to, they kind of migrated to a much softer position about some of this stuff as it began to be debunked and disproven. You know, like 6 foot separation, mass, this, that, the way that it spreads, all kinds of different things, you know, that we were doing out there that completely modified and altered life as we've known it. And we find ourselves here today. Now, it seems to me, and you tell me if I'm wrong, there are a lot of people trying to recapture the moment that we have this blind faith in what the CDC, NIH, and the FDA are saying. I believe that's a wasted energy. I don't think we're ever getting back there. Your thoughts?
I would say I agree with your statement there. Ultimately, granted, I don't have scientific degrees, but what I do have is confidence in my creator that he can keep my health in stable position with faith in him. And, you know, the science, what science I do observe is that when they were working on these varied vaccines, they were using stem cells, they were using rat cells, they were using monkey cells, they were going out into the street and digging up some dirt and throwing it in there to see, okay, what's the next best solution? And you know what? It's Frankenstein science as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I don't know about all of that, but I do agree that, you know, they have lost the faith and there were too many conflicting statements and conflicting opinions. And you know, we're now finding out that a number of them lied to us during the course of this pandemic through some of these hearings. And that's never good. And, you know, we're ending up with documents being subpoenaed, and now there's an evidence trail that supports something completely and totally contrary to what they went to the mic and told us for months on end. That's not good by any stretch of the imagination. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays itself out and where it ends, for sure. Patrick, thank you so much for calling in. Appreciate it. Got to get to a break. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. We will be right back, folks. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We have been very fortunate to have access to Colonel Alex Gann. He's a retired colonel and fighter pilot, retired fighter pilot for the Israeli Air Force, and he joins us again today. Colonel, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Good evening.
Colonel, first, how are you doing, and how's your family doing?
Well, basically, we are all okay, so nothing to worry about us. But you know, the mood and the general situation is bothering all of us. But we're working to correct it.
I know there's been a lot of differences of opinion inside the state of Israel about how to best procure the release of the hostages. What is the chatter now in the streets of Israel?
Well, I'll put it this way. It's most likely the population against the government. I think there's a huge majority among the, no matter from what party, that we have to get the hostages out no matter what. No matter what the cost is. Because they're actually the only 20, maybe less, left alive. They're suffering there. We know and we see what they're going through. And we must get them back ASAP. But the government, especially Bibi, he has his own ideas and his own agenda. So there are demonstrations now every day all over the country, and rallies and strikes and whatever, that we want them to get the hostages. But this is the government we have. We're not proud of it.
So right now there's a proposed offensive by Prime Minister Netanyahu and there's a lot of friction from the Israeli military chief, the foreign minister, as well as the Mossad spy agency chief about, you know, concerns about going into Gaza City and what will they gain, but more importantly, what will they lose? And then what is the next step, which seems to be something that's elusive as they continue to talk about this.
Exactly. You know, we feel, you know, the idea, it can go into Gaza. You know, an army has always difficulties fighting guerrilla or terrorist groups, which are hiding among the population. It's very difficult. Now, if we want to go into Gaza, we can go into Gaza, and we will conquer Gaza, and we will put Gaza in ruins back to the ground. That's not the issue. The question is, of course, if we have hostages in Gaza, most likely, what will happen to them? What will happen? We know we will lose soldiers doing this this mission, but the main question is the hostages. And it's just now, today, it's 700 days since they were taken hostage. And we know they are in a terrible physical and mental condition. So we think, as I said, the most of the population, get them home. And even if it means getting the army out of Gaza, we also took the army out of Lebanon. And we had an agreement in Lebanon, and we are maintaining peace in that front, and Hezbollah under a tight control. That can be done in Gaza as well. But you have to close the whole deal. Hamas will not surrender, because Hamas is an idea. It's a religious. It's not only a group, and they really don't care about the population in Gaza. So we will see what we'll do. They're actually starting now to move into Gaza. It will be terrible, I think.
Hamas seems to be set on maintaining their position of support for a ceasefire that would free some of the hostages. They never give you a definitive number, right? And in the hopes of beginning talks to end the war. But I think it's obvious to everyone, and I'm curious if the Israeli population believes this, that Hamas is just trying to save itself, and they don't intend to give over Gaza to anybody. They want to stay in control of Gaza.
Yes, of course. But, again, if we had a wise plan, which means, okay, let's get someone else to control Gaza, or the Palestinian Authority, or there was a willingness from the Egyptians and the Emirates to send in forces too as well. And basically the main idea is to get Hamas at least to surrender its weapons. Mm-hmm. I think that can be done, but you cannot, we cannot go after each and every one of the Hamas people. You know, I think the estimation is that we killed about, let's say, 20,000 Hamas militants, and almost all their commanders are dead. But they recruit, you know, 15-year-olds, and they pay them $100 to go and put a bomb somewhere. You can never get rid of them, really. Can't go after the last one. So that's what we think, you know, even if a deal must be done. Now, the deal which was on the table was actually our prime minister's idea, is to have 10 returned and then 60 days of ceasefire to get the talks done. Now, Hamas more or less agrees to that, but now our prime minister says no, he wants all of them out. To tell you the truth, I don't believe we will ever see all of them back. Not all of them alive, and not all the dead ones. I'm not sure Hamas knows where all of them are. And it's going to be a hard time. But it's time to end this war. Enough is enough.
Is there a strong belief that Egyptians or someone like that, a group of the Arab world to, that could come in and run Gaza and really be able to maintain kind of an objective and independent view that would actually protect Israel's rights?
We think, you know, that it can be done with the assistance of Israel. And we have very good intelligence in Gaza. And like we do in Lebanon now, you know, we're assisting the Lebanese army controlling Hezbollah, and we attack Hezbollah every time they start to group together. This can be done in Gaza as well. But someone has to say...
But you would agree that... But you would agree that the dynamics in Lebanon are just a little bit more nuanced, right? I mean, it's not like the Lebanese folks really cuddled themselves up to Hezbollah in the south.
They did. They did in the middle, but now the Lebanese recognize that they have an opportunity which they didn't have for almost 40 years. To get their state back, and they have the assistance of the U.S. and they have the assistance of Israel, so they know it's their last chance. So they are very determined to do that. In Gaza, there's no one who is determined to do that. But right. You know, if someone will have to come in, and Israel will help them. And even if it's the Palestinian Authority, and although Israel doesn't want the Palestinian Authority in Gaza, but I think they're the only ones. Actually, in certain places in Gaza, there are tribes and huge families, you know, the big Arab families, which are against Hamas. And they rule certain areas. So, and Israel actually supports them. See, there's certain groups. They are not, I would say, the most trustable people in the world, but they're against Hamas. So it's a very complex situation, but I think our Israel should do better. We deserve better, and our government is not doing the best job, which we can expect from them as a government of Israel.
You know, one of the big... I think one of the big complicating factors and a huge letdown, not only to Israel, but the entire world, is the inability of the United Nations to get their vision straight, you know, to have 2020 vision instead of this jaded view and perspective that they have, that they're looking at this through the Palestinian lens and the Palestinian lens only, there would be a role for them, but that just further complicates this situation.
No, we don't want that. Look, Hezbollah had members of the United Nations working for them. The United Nations had the UNRWA, which is the United Nations help or organization in Gaza. A lot of them were Hamas people. A lot of the Hamas bunkers were under the UN posts.
Yeah.
And we know what the UN, we don't trust the UN. They lie about everything. Actually, the big problem today, I think, is that even nobody in the world, not even the press, not even that, can know the difference between a truth and a lie. And if you have the story, everything of all the stories about, you know, Gaza starving to death, there was a food problem in Gaza. But the amount of people who were really starving there is nothing to compare to Yemen, which you have 500,000 people starving over there, nothing to do compared to Sudan, which you have 10 million people starving over there. But, you know, when you make a good propaganda, and I must say the Hamas did a terrific job. You know, even the New York Times, when it posts a picture of a child, you know, he's starving. And a day later, when you show that this picture is of a child who's sick and actually is in Italy, they don't say, oh, sorry, they don't apologize. They put something in writing and 10 pages in the corner. So it's hard to know what is the truth and what is a lie. Actually, we see a lot of pictures coming out of Gaza. Just last week, you know, the new coffee shop opened in Gaza, a new meat restaurant opened in Gaza. And it's not opened when you have a starvation there. Someone comes there to eat, and someone supplies them with the food. So it's a complex issue, a very complex issue.
This whole famine thing in Gaza really got overstated, and as you said, it was a great, you know, successful PR move, I should say, on a part of Hamas to get people to believe something that was entirely different, mm-hmm. especially when they were completely and totally culpable, right? They were the mm-hmm. biggest problems of getting the food there in the first instance. Mm-hmm. It's just amazing to me how nobody sees what's actually going on, you know, and you know, once the mainstream media starts showing up there and seeing the distribution centers and how this is working and the chaos that's actually caused, in many cases intentionally to try and be disruptive. It's a little disappointing when they still can't report it objectively.
There's no objectively anymore. It's all you see, you know, people coming in, you see Al Jazeera, which grew to be a media monster, which has, you know, tons of money and people all over. They're lying their teeth out, you know, but on anything. And no one tells them they can't say a word to them. And, you know, we don't expect objectivity from many, many reporters. It all depends on what you show them. And right. And you know, when the reporters will go back again into Gaza, it will be terrible because a lot of parts of the Gaza Strip are actually ruins, because they have, you know, miles and miles of tunnels. And when you blow up the tunnels, you blow up the whole area over there. And right. When when Hamas booby traps buildings, and you cause them to explode, so they collapse. It's not over. So that's why I say we should end it as soon as possible, and get the hostages back. This is the most important thing. I think it's very important to our culture and who we are as a people, as Israel, and you know, the Jewish people always considered freeing hostages as one of the most important things you can do as a community. And now we're not fulfilling it, and it's a huge burden on the country, on the people, and on our culture.
What are there discussions about? Let's say everything works out. There's a ceasefire, hostages released. There's a peace deal. Are we thinking about how does this get rebuilt? I mean, you're looking at it. A 30-year trek, right? I mean, this is not.
Look, to build it, you have to build the whole Gaza Strip. Most, I would say, not everything, but a great deal of it is in ruins. And basically, you have to build it. And actually, it will be good for the Palestinians if they build it. You know, you build new communities and new buildings, and you build new everything, so they can have a new society. If there will be, I would say, if they'll have a good leadership, they can become a great place. But if Hamas is there, it will not happen. I think the countries who are willing to support it financially, which is most likely the Emirates and Saudi Arabia and Qatar, at least the Emirates and the Saudis will put conditions on their putting in the money there to the people of Gaza. But it's for us to see. It has to be done as a good... someone has to work at the whole deal. Actually, I was hoping that maybe Trump's team will say, okay, this is the deal, take it now, and that's it. Let's finish it. And maybe this still will happen. We'll see.
Yeah, let's hope so. it needs to come to an end sooner rather than later, obviously, for sure. As always, Colonel, we truly appreciate your time and your insight, and please stay safe. You and your family are always in my thoughts and prayers.
Thank you very much.
We look forward to talking to you the next time, hopefully with better news.
Yes, we hope so. Thank you. Good night. Bye-bye.
Thank you, sir. That's Colonel Alex Gann, retired colonel and fighter pilot for the Israeli Air Force, now living in a small village in northern Israel. We will be back, folks, 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. No big surprise, there was another poll published this week. A telephone survey of 520 New Orleans voters was conducted by the New Orleans pollster Dr. Silas Lee. And it talks about the residents' frustrations with city infrastructure. 71% of respondents rated the maintenance of street drainage as fair or poor. 79% said the condition of streets in their neighborhood was fair or poor. Street conditions like potholes and flooding had caused damage to 72% of respondents' vehicles. Think about that. 7 out of 10 vehicles in this city has had damage as a result of potholes or flooding. The poll said 92% of respondents had been affected by power outages and 75% had been affected by flooding. It's not a pretty picture. What's clear, and you've heard me say this a million times, is the setting of our priorities must be that New Orleanians want their leaders to focus on basics. Reliable electricity, drainage that actually drains, clean water, right? And not having to boil water and things of that nature. So it is clear that as a result of this poll, poll after poll after poll after poll is saying we want our tax dollars spent on these things that are going to be a direct line to the quality of life that we have here in the city. Forget about all this ideological BS that we want to involve ourselves in and start spending dollars on. That has to wait. We want a sewer system that works and performs. We want a drainage system that works and performs, right? We want a water system that works and performs. We want our street lights repaired. We want our traffic signal lights to be working. And we want our potholes fixed. Let's focus. Let's do an all hands on deck approach to this. And we need to put blinders on for a while and not worry about all that other stuff until we get this fixed. Fundamentally, the way that we deal with it, the way that we handle it. And then we could take on some of the other issues, like maybe blight. 20-something thousand blighted homes still exist 20 years after Katrina. That's a tragedy, right? We're suffering here because we don't have affordable housing, but yet we have these homes and absentee property owners, and we're not moving these properties. We have a process where the city can take it over. We can get this back into the stream of commerce, increase our tax base, get people affordable housing at the same time, and then we can move on to some of the other issues. Hopefully, these candidates are listening. But hopefully also, that you are constantly reminding them of same. Speaking of reminding, early voting starts September 27th. It's a Saturday, and it ends the following Saturday, October the 4th, for the October 11th election. We'll be right back. Just a reminder, folks, we believe in the power of everywhere. Listen to WWL anytime, anywhere. Get the WWL shows you love. Dave Cohen, Tommy Tucker, myself, Scoot, Sports Talk, and the local content you crave on the Odyssey, iHeartRadio, and the TuneIn apps. We're all over the place. All right, when we come back after the top of the hour news break, big football weekend, we'll visit with Chris Blair, voice of the LSU Fighting Tigers. They take on La Tech Sunday evening. And we'll also visit with Mike Haas, voice of the New Orleans Saints, as the Arizona Cardinals come into the Caesars Superdome for the opening game of the Saints season. So we're looking forward to that. We'll visit with Chris Blair and Mike Haas when we return. So stay with us. This is Newell on WWL.